Is it too dangerous to vote in person? 8 pages of guidelines from the Secretary of State's office on how to stay safe while casting a ballot. That story today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. New safety guidelines for election season and how they're connected to the fight over mail-in ballots in Texas. Also, how a pandemic is an unseen player in congressional races statewide. An innovative program in Bexar County to help tens of thousands furloughed and fired with payments plus retraining. And apprehensions at the border, the lowest ever. A PolitiFact check plus a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets started. And that happens right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 27th day of May, 2020. I'm David Brown. Happy Wednesday, one and all. Great to have you with us. Information is a powerful thing. Too much of it can be awkward, especially in an era of social media. Too much information could be dangerous, too, an axiom held closely by monarchs, tyrants, and autocrats since time immemorial. We know this by how the Founding Fathers tried to incorporate freedoms of press and speech back in 1791, but we still see signs of it in efforts to wall off the internet in many countries today. But how much is too much? A few weeks back, when some local election officials in Texas began suggesting that voters ask for mail-in ballots to avoid having to risk catching the coronavirus at the polls, the Attorney General of Texas stepped in. AG Ken Paxton issued an opinion stating not only that fear of coronavirus was not a qualification for a mail-in ballot, but suggesting that those who recommend that voters get one might be themselves violating the law. This led to the current ping-pong game in the courts, a fight that now involves both the Texas Supreme Court and the federal courts, too. On social media, many began advising fellow Texans to request a mail-in ballot and claim a disability, since the form does not require people requesting such a ballot to elaborate on what their disability is, and county clerks don't have the tools or resources to inquire. A case of too much information? Apparently, the Texas Secretary of State's office now has decided to enter the information wars, too, publishing an 8-page document of protocols for safe in-person voting, a move that's difficult to separate from the ongoing battle over who gets to vote by mail in Texas and who doesn't. James Barragan has been following all of this for the Dallas Morning News. James, welcome back to The Standard.
Hey, David. It's good to be back.
As the debate over mail-in voting plays out in the courts, this document from the Texas Secretary of State, Ruth Hughes, comes out, a blueprint for what state leaders see as the way to provide safe in-person voting. Who's the audience for this document? Is it election officials or voters in general?
I think it's a little bit of both. They said in their 8-page document that it was for voters, it was for poll workers, it was for poll watchers. And then I think also that in some ways, it's also a part of the audience is the judges and the justices who are going to be deciding these elections lawsuits. You know, the state has been very clear that they don't want mail voting to happen, or they argue that it makes it easy to commit voter fraud. And the reality is that there has been voter fraud through mail voting in the past, and that's the way that it mostly happens. It's not through in-person voting. But it's very minimal compared to the millions and millions of votes cast in every election year in Texas. So the state, though, is arguing we can make in-person voting safe so that we don't have to expand mail voting beyond what we have right now. And that's basically what they laid out in the document that we're talking about.
So about these safety measures, what's included? What's the Secretary of State say?
So there's calls for having hand sanitizer, disinfectant wipes at the ready for voters and for workers. There's also calls for markers on the ground to designate 6 feet barriers so that everybody can maintain the social distance. Voting stations are going to be 6 feet apart from one another. Face coverings are not required, but they are encouraged. And that's the sort of dance that state officials have been doing all along, of course, on face coverings. But there are two exceptions to that. If there is a poll worker who is your voter assistant, meaning that they're helping you to vote because, say, you don't understand the language or you need help marking up your ballot because of a disability, they are going to be required to wear a face covering. Or if you're doing curbside voting, probably, again, because of a disability, those workers are also going to be required to have face coverings. So those are some of the prescriptions that are in the guidance. Of course, voting rights advocates say that those are still not enough, that the only safe way to do this is to expand mail ballots. And so we're going to have a resolution, I think, in the next couple of weeks here to see what the courts are going to say.
Is there anything in these protocols that suggests that poll workers would be taking temperatures at the doors? Can someone show up with symptoms but request curbside voting, for example? How does this play out?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that it's important to say that these are, and the Secretary of State said that these are the minimum requirements, that there's nothing stopping counties from adding more additional requirements. So right now, the actual election workers will be screened by the county election administrators, meaning that if they have any symptoms, they won't be allowed to come in and be poll workers. Voters, on the other hand, have a little bit of a trickier situation in that they are going to be self-screening themselves. And if they have any symptoms, then they have to sort of scramble at the end of the day and try to get an emergency ballot, which the voting rights advocates have already said. It's like, how is that even going to happen? If it's past the deadline to apply for a different way of voting, how is that exactly going to work? And I think we're gonna hear more about how that's supposed to work in the next couple of weeks, and that might factor into the decision from the courts. But I think, again, going back to, this is the minimum that the Secretary of State has said. There's nothing stopping a county from saying, hey, you can screen voters at the entrances. But that, I think, is going to be up to the counties and the local governments to make that happen. And of course, that's going to cost some money. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
There's a whole lot more detail in James Barragán's story for the Dallas Morning News. We'll link to it at texasstandard.org. James, thanks again.
Hey, thank you.
Texas's 10th congressional district stretches from Houston to Austin. This summer, two Democrats will compete in a runoff for the chance to challenge Republican Michael McCaul, who's held that seat for 8 terms. But since COVID-19's made it virtually impossible to campaign in person, Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider looks at how the candidates are staying relevant.
The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee has named the Texas 10th as one of its top targets to flip in the fall. But most outside observers see the race as Republican Michael McCaul's to lose. One of the Democrats running for that chance is Dr. Pritesh Gandhi. Up until March, Gandhi split his time between the campaign trail and his community health clinic in Austin. Now, with COVID-19, Gandhi spends almost every waking hour at the clinic.
How are things going?
He starts a typical Monday early. First, he reviews charts and helps his kids with homework. Then he heads to the droplet clinic.
These are our respiratory clinics that are specifically designed for patients who we are suspecting may have coronavirus.
Next, the drive-through testing site, where Gandhi swabs patients to test them for coronavirus. In the afternoon, he'll hop into a telemedicine clinic.
And then in the evening, it's campaign until I pass out on my desk.
That involves speaking with community leaders, campaign staff, and volunteers. People who keep Gandhi's campaign going while he's saving lives. His clinic serves thousands of Central Texans who work multiple jobs and lack insurance.
What I am seeing in the midst of all of this is these historical structural inequities, often rooted in race and ethnicity and income, are being magnified by this pandemic.
Another Democrat trying to unseat McCaul is Mike Siegel, a civil rights lawyer who ran and lost against McCaul in 2018. Right now, Siegel is balancing his campaign with homeschooling his two kids.
My wife is an essential worker. She runs a veterinary practice in Austin, so she's been working throughout the pandemic. And so I'm delivering curriculum and making calls and trying to keep everything moving.
Siegel knows most people are more concerned about survival than politics. So he's helping local food banks and advocating for voting rights.
I'm the lead lawyer in a lawsuit suing the state of Texas to end the ban on so-called mobile voting, which is a lot of what early voting used to be. and then also fighting on this issue of universal access to vote by mail.
Meanwhile, his campaign staff works the phones. They're finding more people are picking up because they're stuck at home. That benefits Republican incumbent Michael McCaul as well. His volunteers are making tens of thousands of calls, and he's holding virtual town halls. Then there's his work in Congress. McCaul says he's tracking federal money meant for hospitals for COVID-19 relief.
But mostly during this crisis, it's been trying to lead, you know, in a time of crisis, making sure that when we pass these bills in Congress that the money is going to where it's supposed to be going.
He's working closely with Texas Children's Hospital and MD Anderson Cancer Center. McCaul also runs the China Task Force, an all-Republican body working on a national security response to Beijing. McCaul blames the Chinese government for the spread of coronavirus and its economic fallout.
If anything positive came out of COVID-19, it's that the American people woke up to this fact that we're just too reliant on the Chinese government for so many supply chain items that are really critical infrastructure.
Democrats are targeting McCaul's seat because his last re-election was his closest ever. Early voting to pick his challenger begins June 29th. In Houston, I'm Andrew Schneider.
Joining us once again on this Wednesday, social media editor Wells Dunbar. Hello there, Wells.
Hello, David. The Texas Secretary of State's minimum guidelines for safe in-person voting coming under scrutiny on social media. On our Facebook page, Brad Emmons asks about measures to mitigate risk for poll workers spending hours indoors with passing lines of strangers. He sees nothing about ventilation standards for polling places. Joyce Logel says the guidelines are ridiculous and asks, isn't requiring people to provide their own masks and hand sanitizer tantamount to a poll tax? Justin Klumpner says if you need 8 pages of instructions on how to do something safely, it probably isn't safe enough for the general public. And Rachel Elizabeth asks, where is the state's plans to deal with the expected shortage in poll workers, many of whom are over 65 and at higher risk? How exactly are they recruiting more poll workers to cover the doubled early voting period? Some of the questions we're seeing out there today, David, on this and plenty of other stories on social media. I'll be back with more reactions later in the program.
Sounds like a lot of skepticism about this. Or maybe not. I mean, maybe you support what the Secretary of State is trying to do here. We'd love to hear from you either way. You know what to do. Look for us on social media. Just check out Texas Standard on Facebook or Twitter. Coming up on 19 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard time. Wells Dunbar, I'll be back in about 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, helping patients fight cancer with telemedicine. Virtual online appointments are available for patients to continue their cancer journey while practicing safe social distancing. More at TexasOncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at BecomeACASA.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Zoos across much of Texas are on the list to reopen on Friday, and in Dallas and Fort Worth at least, visitors can expect some new additions as well as some new rules when they come to see the animals. KERA's Ana Perez has more.
Both zoos are experiencing something they've never really encountered before. No visitors. Avery Elander is with the Fort Worth Zoo. She says the animals haven't really noticed.
Their daily routines have not changed. It is just a little different for the staff just because it's so quiet around here.
Spring is the Fort Worth Zoo's busiest season with close to 100,000 visitors in the park. The zoo closed in March, but the staff has hosted Facebook Live keeper chats a few times a week. The Dallas Zoo has also stayed connected with visitors virtually. This time of year, the zoo could have as many as 15,000 guests a day. Matt James is a senior director of animal care.
I have friends from all over the United States that are even engaging with Dallas Zoo animals through our social media accounts.
The Dallas Zoo also welcomed a new animal this month, a male giraffe calf named Kendi. Zookeepers are still doing their check-ins with signature residents like the elephants.
Good morning, Jabu. Nice to see you, bud. Ears.
And are getting a little more creative on how to engage with the animals, says James with the Dallas Zoo.
Cooney pigs get to go and explore. It's really fun if they walk by the otter habitat and the otters haven't seen the pigs ever or maybe in a very long time. And so then there's that curious response.
Both zoos will ask visitors to reserve tickets in advance and will enforce face masks and social distancing starting Friday. I'm Ana Perez in Dallas.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Among the many questions hanging over elected officials these days, what to do about the most dire economic crisis in recent memory? Thanks to COVID-19, over 1.8 million people have filed for unemployment in Texas since early March, and of those, more than 115,000 have been in Bexar County alone. To help some of them, officials in the San Antonio area have an idea: a $450 a week stipend for unemployed workers to attend job retraining programs. The hope is to help people pay their bills while acquiring skills to rejoin the workforce. Joining us now to tell us more, one of the people behind this plan, Bexar County Commissioner Justin Rodriguez. Commissioner Rodriguez, welcome to the Texas Standard.
David, thank you. It's always a pleasure to join you.
So tell us a little bit more about where the money for this program is going to come from, because I would think it would not be an inconsiderable amount.
Yeah, no, it's a significant amount. And keep in mind, we've received at least an initial round of stimulus dollars from the federal government under the CARES Act, right? That was the act that was passed a few weeks back in order to help local communities recuperate and put dollars back into the economy. So this first tranche, we got the county about $80 million. We're proposing to put half of that, about $40 million, into a workforce training program. We know unemployment is high. We know people are still seeing the initial effects of being out of work. And so we're trying to rethink how we do this. And we know in order to get people into retraining programs, they're going to have to be in a few weeks of training. And the only way for people to do that, still make ends meet, put food on the table, provide for their families, is to provide a stipend.
Well, now, what kind of job would be pandemic proof in San Antonio?
Great question, right? So that's part of our challenge is, we have to look at this differently than we have in years and decades past. We don't know what jobs are resilient enough to get through this. What we do know is that the service industry, those that maybe worked in the hotel, restaurant industry, those jobs will be slow coming back. And so if there's a possibility to get somebody in a healthcare field, we know that those are resilient jobs. They're going to be here, pandemic or not. IT tech jobs are going to be here, pandemic or not. So part of this is a little bit shooting at a moving target. We've got to figure out what those jobs will look like in 6 months or 12 months down the road.
Just thinking about job openings, I wonder, Commissioner, if you see this as a piece of what might be a sort of broader restructuring of the economy in San Antonio. Is this program, do you see it as more of a stopgap, or is this a jumping off point for something long term?
No, I think it's got to be, in a way, hitting the reset button. Not that we're going to completely wipe out service industry. Look, we'll always be, because of the Alamo, because of the Riverwalk, we'll always have some reliance on the tourism industry. But at the same time, I think this is an opportunity for people to invest in themselves and making them more marketable and employable.
But you're also sort of racing against the clock because these federal dollars won't be available forever, as I understand it. And then, of course, there's a question of whether or not there might be more applicants for this opportunity than available slots, or are you keeping this open-ended? How are you going to work this?
Sure. Yeah. So there's two things happening. Number one, I can speak for the county only. I know it's early, but the city's also talking about creating a similar program to mirror what we're doing at the county level. We may only have, with our 40 million slots for 5,000 individuals. We also, as you mentioned, are racing against the clock here because under the CARES Act, we have to expend these dollars by 12/31/2020. So, we're on the one hand trying to get this program up and running. We're also lobbying on the other side to see if the federal government will give us more time, because that's 6 or 7 months. And we know that if you're going to make a significant change in people and their skills, it's going to take longer. So we're also asking for a little bit more time. So this is a starting point, but by no means is it an end.
Assuming that everything goes as planned, what's your hope for when you can actually
plug it in and get everything up and running? What do you have a time in mind?
I think optimistically, you know, we're here at almost the end of May. I think optimistically we've got to get this thing going in early summer. So as soon as, you know, the next 2 to 4 weeks is my hope. Now, keep in mind, we've got to find partners that fill the necessary void. Now those conversations are occurring. I know they are. But in order to get all the I's dotted and T's crossed, it's going to take a few weeks. So I'm hoping we can get people in this program as soon as this summer and get them the training they need over the next few months.
I'm wondering if this couldn't be the start of something longer term, maybe something that continues after the pandemic, or no?
Well, I think the one-time shot in the arm is certainly going to be, at least in terms of federal dollars, it is going to be responsive to the global pandemic, right? So,
sure.
You know, the $80 million we got, we're hopeful for additional dollars. I don't know that that'll be, you know, a recurring investment in local communities. We do know this. I mean, at some point, both the local, state, and federal governments will have to figure out a way to create additional jobs, whether that's through a traditional public works infrastructure type bill. But we're going to have to figure out, you know, those jobs are going to be there, the construction jobs, the engineering jobs. Part of our role as government is to help create those jobs and restart a lagging economy. And so this may be a series of investments the federal government's making, and we're going to have to put those dollars to work as soon as possible.
Justin Rodriguez represents Precinct 2 at the Bexar County Commissioner's Court. Commissioner Rodriguez, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out of your busy schedule to speak with us on the Texas Standard. We appreciate it.
Enjoyed it. Thank you, David.
Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com, available in the dairy aisle. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Tech University's online school program, TTU K-12, offering fully online courses for kindergarten through 12th grade to start anytime from anywhere. Learn more by searching TTU K-12.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Governor Greg Abbott will be in Amarillo this afternoon to update the public on efforts to contain coronavirus hotspots across Texas. Earlier this month, Abbott sent a surge response team to the Panhandle to test meatpacking plant employees for the virus. More than half of all COVID-19 cases in Amarillo are related to that industry. Meanwhile, the meatpacking industry also appears to be contributing to a COVID-19 outbreak in the Sherman-Denison metropolitan area, which is about 70 miles north of Dallas. According to a New York Times analysis, the cities in Grayson County have the sixth fastest growth rate in the U.S., with 198 cases confirmed over the last 2 weeks. Grayson County Judge Bill Majors explains the virus spread mostly among workers at a local meat processing facility and two other large employers.
So what we've done is basically identified those positive cases, moved them out of the workforce temporarily, into home quarantine, and we're managing the situation. So it's not a community spread in the traditional sense. We've had clusters of these in industry.
Grayson County reports two people have died from COVID-19. Two San Antonio area congressmen are calling on the federal government to cancel a contract with a local event planner to distribute food boxes. Democrats Joaquin Castro and Lloyd Doggett are questioning why the U.S. Department of Agriculture awarded $39 million to Create a Date, which has no experience providing this type of service. Doggett, who also represents parts of Austin, says the USDA moved too quickly.
That may have been necessary to help Ivanka Trump with a photo op, but it certainly did not honor the needs of the hungry, the taxpayers, the distributors, or the producers, a number of whom probably had food about to go to waste.
Doggett says Create a Date has yet to distribute any of the 750,000 food boxes the contract requires. Texas state parks began accepting new overnight reservations today after temporarily putting camping on hold due to the pandemic. Campers can book stays between June 1st and September 7th. Texas Parks and Wildlife Department spokesperson Stephanie Garcia says the number of reservations available will be limited at certain parks to comply with public health guidelines.
So we really recommend that everyone who wants to do an overnight camping trip or even a day trip go online and check our reservation system, see if there's availability, and to make sure to reserve those spots.
Texas Parks and Wildlife recommends visitors wear face coverings and bring their own hand sanitizer. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from BiteAway, a chemical-free treatment alternative to instantly relieve the itch and pain caused by insect bites. Portable, reusable, and no mess. Suitable for children. Learn more at TakeTheBiteAway.com.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time, I'm David Brown. Pandemic or not, it's summer, which means no matter what type of health precautions state and local leaders are proffering, there's going to be a whole lot more violations now that the weather's better. Despite a 25% capacity rule issued by Governor Abbott, lots of complaints came in over the Memorial Day weekend, and many of those came with photographic evidence of people pushing that capacity way past the 25% limit. Here to talk with us about it now and how or if officials are enforcing that limit, Houston Fire Department's Deputy Chief Allison Stein. Chief Stein, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you very much.
I'm sure you saw the pictures on social media, those packed pools and other crowded venues. What can local officials do, and what is Houston law enforcement and fire teams, what are they able to do?
So we don't believe that that was the particular picture that you're speaking out. We don't think that was a recent picture. There's no evidence, and we can't find anywhere that was recent. We responded to that particular location over the weekend several times, and they have been in compliance. What we are doing in the Houston Fire Department is operating a task force made up of anywhere from 11 to 9 investigators and 11 to 9 inspectors with a couple of supervisors on duty. And we respond to complaints from citizens complaining about businesses that are not in compliance with the governor's orders. But with that said, what we are enforcing is the 25% capacity of bars and 50% capacity of restaurants. We are not issuing citations right now. We are not closing down businesses. We have been lucky that most of the businesses that we respond to are either in compliance or willing to get in compliance. We're getting a good report from most businesses who are happy to see us there because we are educating on social distancing. We're passing out masks. And a lot of the times the businesses need help with their customers. Hmm. And when they see us there, they are relieved that they have someone to help them try to gain compliance.
I don't mean to in any way diminish the importance or significance of the rules or, for that matter, the enforcement. But on the other hand, it strikes me that you could end up with a lot of complaints and then you come to find out that someone's seen a picture on Twitter or heard something from someone else that you're not able to actually ascertain. Is this the best use of your time, taking these complaints from citizens?
I believe so, because like I said, a lot of the businesses are happy to see us and they need our help. You're absolutely right. A lot of the complaints that are coming in are anonymous, and we have a lot of competitors filing complaints on competitors. Over the weekend, we had several hundred complaints come in. We have been extremely busy, but like I said, I think since we are not closing down business, we are only helping gain compliance, I think it's a welcome sight.
So are you getting actually, if I understand what you're saying, you're getting called out to bars, or is this something that you're sort of taking upon yourselves to educate people?
No, someone will file a complaint with 311, and it'll go through the system. Harris County will then ascertain whether it's county or city, and then we get it and log it in and send our teams out there.
I see. So you actually are called out to bars and that kind of thing. You're assigned to actually go in and check.
Yes, and restaurants or any establishment that is somebody feels is not in compliance with the order. And if it's a residence or outside park or something, we refer them to Houston Police Department.
Once you've done that initial job of explaining to people the importance of the 25% rule, of having face masks and that kind of thing, if you have to return, what then? Is there a point at which, okay, well, we're going to have to crack down, we're going to have to issue citations, or
How would you handle a situation like that, or have you had to handle a situation like that?
We have not had to issue citations since the beginning of May, I believe. We are not going to be issuing citations. We are not going to shut down businesses other than if they're over the occupancy limit. And that's for the protection of the customers for a public health issue.
Is that a concern to you? I mean, that perhaps the spread could continue if no citations, or if there's no,
pardon me for interrupting. It is a concern to me that it will spread if we are not going to educate and follow through with what the governor's orders are.
What about citations or arrests? I mean, if people feel like that they're just going to get a lecture, is it possible that this could go on?
Right now, we're going to continue our task force while the judge's orders are in place, and that's until June 10th. So past that, we haven't had any direction that we're going to go beyond that. If she puts out another stay-home order, then we'll continue our task force.
So you're talking about Harris County Judge Hidalgo, is that right?
Correct. So we're following her stay-home order on the deadline. We're following the governor's orders as it pertains to occupancy.
Allison Stein is a deputy chief with the Houston Fire Department. Chief Stein, thank you so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard. We certainly do appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Maxfield Rivers. I'm about to graduate from Westwood High School. The Friday of spring break, we learned that spring break was going to be extended. And so, yeah, spring break is going to become the rest of the school year. So we just had to kind of change what we were planning to do with that. I mean, the last choir concert of the year, the last orchestra concert, competitions, prom. Yeah, there was a lot of disappointment that I was going to miss all of that. And of course, the last few months with my high school friends and my teachers. You know, I think a lot of people are struggling with online learning. Personally, I really like it. Because now that I have so much, I'm spending so much less time with actual classwork, I'm able to focus my energy on things that I'm passionate about. And I've found that to be a real gift, actually. Well, I had a lot of anxiety about COVID-19, and I solve my anxiety sometimes by getting more information. So I decided that I would reach out to experts and try to understand more about what was going on in the world with COVID-19. And then I thought, well, if I'm asking these questions, other people are probably asking these questions. So I'd always wanted to do a podcast because I thought it sounded cool. And I just thought, well, this would be the perfect thing to do it on.
I'm Maxfield Rivers, the high school senior trying to host this podcast and figure out what's going on for myself.
Oh, I was so nervous at the beginning to talk to email people and to talk to people. It was really scary. But after I sent the first few emails, I got a lot more comfortable with it. Phone calls I'm still nervous about.
Today, we'll discuss the disease, how it works, and what makes it unique. Later in the episode, we'll talk about lessons from disease movies like Outbreak or Contagion.
I think the process is most important to me. I would say I'm pretty careful with any project. I want to set my expectations high enough that when I reach them, it feels like an achievement, but low enough that if I don't meet my goals, I don't feel disappointed in myself. So really, it was the process of starting this podcast and the opportunity to talk to amazing people. And then, of course, my resume is going to look great. So that was just kind of a bonus, is that I get to put it on my resume. So there is still kind of the worry that certain schools aren't going to reopen in the fall and that I'm going to have to stay at home and do online classes, but I think that's something that I can manage. I'm Maxfield Rivers, a graduating senior from Westwood High School, and this is the Texas Standard.
As we've been hearing all this week from graduating seniors, this year has stunted a lot of pivotal moments for seniors: prom, graduation, even the classic signature collection on yearbooks. But what about the all-important pre-college preamble given to seniors from high school guidance counselors? Advice and coaching meant to steer seniors in the right direction as they make their way toward their collegiate years. We're joined now by one counselor to tell us how it's going. Joining us is Jennifer Seekins. She's an administrator and counselor with Abilene ISD. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So how are you and other school guidance counselors communicating with high school seniors right now? I guess Zoom, right?
Yes, sir. We set up a system for my students to be able to book a time to visit with me. And so they were able to pick a time in my calendar, and then we Zoomed together to have conversation about their schedules or about whatever they needed to talk about as far as getting ready for college.
I wonder what the most common question is that they have for you.
Most of them were still trying to figure out, you know, finishing up scholarship applications or how to go about finding information to pay for college, still in the midst of all of this, because we were right in that season of filling out those applications and then also for letters of recommendation as they finished up scholarship.
I guess in a sense, some things never change. That's always going to be what a lot of kids are going to be struggling with. But at the same time, this is a rather unique season. Have you been encountering some difficult questions from seniors?
So I'm also the mom of a senior, and I will say I think the most most difficult question that he has asked has been, you know, the question we absolutely can't answer, which is, what does this look like for the fall? Do I still get to go live in the dorm? Do I still get to go off to college? And so that question has been answered a little bit differently across the state by counselors and parents. From a parent perspective, we are still planning for him going to college and living in the dorm and getting to have that experience. And most of the seniors with whom I visit with, that's the way we plan things, for them to be able to have a normal freshman experience.
How did you read the way that young people were experiencing graduation, this thing that they had been building to for the last 12, 13 years? Was it a disappointment?
So on my campus, my seniors, they have some traditions, where at the medical magnet school, we do a stethoscope ceremony where these kids get a stethoscope that is very special as a culminating of their efforts. They were pretty disappointed that we have not had an in-person stethoscope ceremony. We're planning one for later. And a lot of our seniors are going to get that experience as well, as far as graduation is concerned, because they may have had a virtual graduation, but the district's planning something in person for later in July. So though in some cases, they're going to get two ways to celebrate, both a virtual that may have happened, you know, in their homes this past weekend with family, and then they'll have one that'll be at the football stadium later on where they get to walk the stage and get their diploma. Mm-hmm. Just as the normal kids might have.
It strikes me that you're uniquely qualified as not just a guidance counselor, but also as the mother of a senior to talk about possible silver linings here. Do you see any?
Yeah. So the nice thing has been being able to really be with my children during this time, both as their mom and then also as an educator. And in the case of my senior, he came in one day and he'd been on a Zoom conference with his university and had met his roommate through a Zoom conference and has now been able to connect with the person who will be his roommate in the fall. That's been really cool to be able to be home while that's happened and to be there for both of them. My other son will be a freshman in high school next year as they've just finished up this school year. And I've never been able to be home with my kids, you know, other than summer. And so we were just very fortunate that both my husband and I have jobs that could be done from home, and we're able to be there together. And we know that's not the case for many families that they had to continue to go to work, and then their child had to go to work so that they could figure out how to pay the bills and that sort of thing. And I know I have students in that boat, and I know that they would, they'd probably feel very differently and probably feel very robbed in a way that my boys have not been.
Jennifer Seekins is an administrator and counselor with Abilene ISD. Ms. Seekins, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard. We certainly do appreciate it.
Yes, thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Donald Trump was recently talking about border apprehensions and said, quoting here, "We have some of the best numbers we've ever had." Is that a fact? Here to parse out these words, Madeline Meckelberg with PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So Mr. Trump made this claim where exactly?
So Trump said this during an interview he did recently on Fox Business, and he was asked by the reporters there how he planned to get the economy back on track after the coronavirus pandemic. And Trump said, you know, "I've always been an America first kind of guy, and I've had these policies in place that reflect that." And he highlighted his actions on the southern border between the U.S. and Mexico as evidence of that fact. And I believe we've got audio of his full statement.
"Strong borders. Our border is very strong. We have some of the best numbers we've ever had. Southern border, the best numbers we've ever had."
Best numbers. That's not very specific. What does he mean by best numbers?
So you're right. I think this number can mean different things depending on who's actually looking at the data. Yeah. But generally, we know that Trump uses this kind of language to talk about a low number of apprehensions being reported at the border. And a few days after this interview he did on Fox, he actually gave a speech and he said, "We're seeing the lowest numbers we've ever had of people coming in right now." So we used that context to look at this claim.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. What about the numbers themselves? Does the data reflect these are the lowest numbers we've ever had, or the best, to use his word?
Right. So the data that we have from Customs and Border Protection shows that the number of apprehensions on the border is relatively low right now, but they're not at the lowest point that we've ever seen through history. And, you know, it's fair that maybe Trump is trying to make a comparison on a month-by-month basis or looking at a specific time frame of years, but he didn't offer that. To kind of give a broader picture here, looking at year-to-date apprehensions right now, they're at the lowest that they've been compared with past years of the Trump administration, but they're definitely not at the lowest point that they've been through history. You know, they were much lower in the 1960s and in earlier years.
Is it clear that we're talking about apprehensions or the numbers of people estimated to be crossing the border? What exactly does that mean, even if you assume that best equals lowest here?
So when Trump is talking about the number of people that are actually coming here, I think that's where things start to get more complicated, because it gets into this territory that we haven't touched yet, and that is the coronavirus and the impact that that is having at the border.
Absolutely.
So Trump was attributing a drop in numbers at the border, which we generally assume to be him referencing apprehensions at the border, and that's when Border Patrol apprehends people trying to enter the country between ports of entry. But we've seen a change in our policy of late due to the coronavirus, and that happened at the end of March. The Trump administration invoked Title 42, which is a section of federal law that lets health officials in the U.S. deny entry to immigrants coming from a country with an outbreak of infectious diseases. And under that law, federal authorities have been expelling immigrants who arrive at the border. And so data we're seeing on Border Patrol activity is kind of broken down into two categories, and that's apprehensions and then also these expulsions. So to give you a picture there, in April, there were 16,000 Border Patrol enforcement actions at the border. Of all of those, just 1,500 were apprehensions and the rest were expulsions.
Very interesting. Okay, well, do we have enough information here to make a ruling, do you think?
I think we do. I just want to really make it clear that the coronavirus is playing a significant role here. We spoke to quite a few experts on dynamics at the border, and they told us that right now, the numbers that we're seeing are really flukes in history, because in addition to these changing policies on our end, people in other countries have governments that are reacting to this, and people are generally less inclined to travel or to try and emigrate somewhere during a health crisis. So that is something that we really need to consider when looking at his claim. So he's right, we're seeing low apprehension numbers, but he wrongly attributes that only to his administration's policies and doesn't take into account the coronavirus. So we rated his claim half true.
Half true. That's PolitiFact's rating for President Trump's claim that apprehensions at the southern border are, quote, some of the best numbers we've ever had, his words. Madeline Meckelberg is with PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, thanks.
Thanks for having me. And you're listening to the Texas Standard.
Joining us once again, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. So, Wells, what are you seeing out there?
Hi, David. Well, by now, most Texans have probably heard about the death of George Floyd, the man that died after a Minneapolis police officer knelt on his neck. His name has been trending on social media ever since video of his arrest went viral on Twitter and elsewhere. Now, the Houston Chronicle reports that Floyd hailed from Houston originally. Offering more background about his life, the Chronicle writes, George Floyd attended Yates High School in Houston's Third Ward, where he earned a basketball scholarship. This is interesting. He also made music with the SUC, or Screwed Up Click. That's DJ Screw's legendary posse of hip-hop collaborators. Yeah. Details of a life that ended after an act of police brutality. The four officers involved in Floyd's arrest have since been fired, with many on social media calling for charges against the officers as well, a story that's continuing to play out on social media. We're also continuing to hear about that story from the top of the show, the Texas Secretary of State's minimum guidelines for safe in-person voting. A guy named Tron, that's the Twitter handle there, he says, honestly, I'm okay with it. He adds that I'm also okay with mail-in ballots, which are safe and used in many places. I think by November we will be more back to normal, so voting should be fine in person by then, with the use of common sense, although he calls to add more polling places throughout to avoid crowds. And I guess that's what state leadership is attempted to do with this lengthening of the early voting period for the runoff elections coming up here. Catherine Cooler Walters, PhD, she tweets, this is a no-go, in reference to those early voting guidelines. She says, after 2 months of trying to social distance whenever in public, I quickly realized that while I can control myself, I cannot control others, and those who view this as a hoax invading personal space as a means to intimidate. She says that fear at election sites is not okay. And referencing, I guess, something else we heard from a listener earlier, David, Dinah tweets us that she can't help but think of the poll workers, like those retirees who do it because they have the luxury of serving as election judges because they're retired. For them, it's important civil service, but for now it could be life-threatening volunteerism, and that isn't okay. It really does raise an interesting question about the role of those volunteer positions, because I recall back when all this started with the municipal elections in March, there were lots of reports here in Austin and in other cities around the state that people weren't showing up due to concerns about coronavirus. That. Yeah.
Interesting story. Dallas News is reporting a Dallas law firm accused of filing predatory lawsuits against patients to collect medical debt. One of many stories we continue to track here at the Texas Standard. In the meantime, go over to dallasnews.com for the latest. We're out of time for the big broadcast. You can keep up with the news at texasstandard.org. Till tomorrow, I'm David Brown, wishing you a wonderful Wednesday.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.